accession number 193911, Reel 2.
Harry Jones, Reel 2. I was just asking you if you gave any of these German prisoners a thump. Yes, we're on.
No, we never had any call to, really, other than their attitude, and we tolerated that.
So that was just a few hours you had in this county-class cruiser?
Oh, yes, only a matter of an hour or so. Well, 10 hours, I should say.
And then you went back to Cormorant?
I wasn't on Cormorant when the county-class cruiser was in this camp at Silent Town. Then a few days afterwards, I joined the Cormorant at Cape Town.
Whilst you were with Cormorant, did you have any action with the enemy?
No, but we had a very, very near do. We just handed a convoy over to the Jervis Bay. And how we came across that was, we left the South Atlantic then and we'd gone to Halifax, Nova Scotia. And the Jervis Bay and the Comorin was doing a convoy alternately. One ship would leave Bermuda with the convoy and the other would leave Halifax, Nova Scotia, with another convoy. And they would come across the Atlantic till, I'll always remember, it was, they said, 20 degrees west. And then the local, we'll say the Western Approaches convoy would take over, which was mainly destroyers and escort vessels, you see. We hadn't got Aztecs or anything on then, and in those days, Jerry hadn't got to the Western Atlantic. But unknown to us, this particular convoy, we handed the convoy over of about, say, 40 ships to the Jervis Bay. And it was our turn to go from, we'd left Halifax and handed the convoy over to the Jervis Bay. And it was our turn then to go back to Bermuda. Then we left the ships over to the Jervis Bay, and at about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, it was noticeable we turned round and was going flat out back in the direction that we'd left. And skipper cleared, he came over the wireless and said that the Jervis Bay was now, convoy so-and-so was being attacked and the Jervis Bay was being shelled on. And we were going back to give assistance. Well, she'd been attacked by, I think it was two German cruisers. Then we'd only got back, on the way back for about 2 hours and we turned around again. And was told to get as far away from the situation as possible, as this raider had more or less annihilated the convoy and the Jervis Bay. And with this, we didn't know what to think then, whether we were cowards in doing this or sensible. Anyway, that was the end of that. And I've always remembered there's a great deal of worry aboard the ship because a lot of the lads on the Jervis Bay were R&R blokes from the north of Scotland, Wick and Stornoway. And a lot of the lads who were personal friends of these. A Swedish ship did pick up nearly all the survivors that was saved, if you like, and there was one instance that there was two brothers called Baines from Wick in the north of Scotland, and one of my messmates were a personal friend of these Baines. Anyway, when we landed, we went back to Halifax instead of Bermuda like we were supposed to. And we went up to the hospital in Halifax to see them. And it's a sight I'll never forget. It was, talk about an ape. There were black cordite had burned in them. What had happened, as they were loading the guns, one of the shells must have hit the gun, and the cordites went up, and both of the two brothers were just one mass of, everything was burnt, all the skin, everything. Anyway, they did survive, and it would be very interesting to see whether they ever did get away with it altogether, like, you know. But that was the one thing that kept in my mind, that.
Where did you see them?
Where?
Whereabouts did you see them?
In a hospital in Halifax, Nova Scotia. When we landed in Halifax, me and Baines, that's what, not Baines, Fraser was my mate, and we both went up to Halifax to hospital to see them. I understood they did survive anyway.
So they were Jarvis Bay survivors?
Jarvis Bay survivors, yeah. Mm.
And you were up in Cormorant. Cormorant had gone to Halifax?
Gone to Halifax. It's not Cormorant, it's, by the way, it's C-O-M-O-R-I-N.
C?
O-M-O-R-I-N.
Cormorant.
We used to call it Comorin. I-N at the end.
Comorin.
Comorin. Mm.
So Comorin used to go as far afield as Nova Scotia?
Oh yeah, we used to go on Halifax and Bermuda all around there.
Any other incidents that happened to you whilst you were in the Comorin?
Well, I was on it when she sank.
What happened?
Well, we'd been into Gorok, and we got repaired. Well, we went into Govan, that was it. Govan up the Clyde, it got refit. And we came out, and we were going north somewhere, I don't know where we were going. And we started, we escorted a ship called the Glenartney. And we had one destroyer with us, HMS Lincoln, which was an old Yankee class, four funnel destroyer, one of those ex-American things like that. And the weather was atrocious, it was blowing almost a hurricane. It was very, very bad, one of the worst times I could remember. And I'd been on watch, and I came off watch at 12:30 midday, and within, I had a meal straight away, and we were on two watches then, port and starboard watch. And within half an hour of going off watch, having a meal, the bugler started sounding blue watch to fire stations, which, well, I wasn't blue watch, I think I was red watch, so I didn't bother to get out of my hammock, thinking it was just some trivial little fire. And a few minutes later, all hands to fire stations. Of course, then it was panic stations then, like, you know, we straight up. And I went straight up the gangway, like that. And all the midships on the ship was on fire. And half an hour previous, nothing was wrong. And what had happened, at least this is what alleged happened, she had a flashback in the boiler room. And all the midships of the ship was on fire. And By this time I was bosun's party on the ship, and I had orders to get all fire hoses. Well, we got them rigged. All the deck by this time was all burning, and I don't think I ever got to the forecastle to get the hose pipes where they were stored, and it got orders to abandon ship. Well, if you'd have seen the weather, it was absolutely terrible. It was, and my abandoned ship till was on a Carly float, and it was obvious there was going to be a lot of trouble. But anyway, it was too bad for the Lincoln to get alongside her to take survivors off. So the officer was coming out, come on, abandoned ship, like, well, she was stopped then, heave to. And you've got to remember the freeboard on these big emerging cruisers was colossal, because she was an ex-liner. And as she was rolling, the gunnels was going almost to the waterline, and the opposite side was up in the air like this. And whoever did thought of rigging the Carly floats never took into account that to give it the extra length when she went over the opposite way, anybody was in the Carly float got thrown up in the air. You see, the rope was too... Anyway.
The rope was too short?
It was all too short, you see. So, with me being in huge small boats, and my hobby on the ship was sailing and all that, right? The officer said to me, come on, Joni, get over and give her. No one wanted to go over because to look at the sea, it was obvious the Carly float wasn't going to last minutes, like, you know. Anyway, I went down and got in it, and we got eight aboard. I was put in charge of this Carly float with a midshipman, and I had my knife on, and I cut the rope. So all the other lads was in the water, so they hadn't got the sense, I suppose, to cut the paint, as we call it then, like, you know. Well, that was all very well, but the trouble was the ship was drifting so fast downwind, with full wind to the wind, the suction of the boat wouldn't let us get away from the ship, you see. Now, if that was the ship, I was over the side there, and this was the bow, and the suction was pulling me down that way. The Glenarney had come up to windward of us like that to try and give us a bit of lee, and the Lincoln had, she was strong where she was. She was taking it very bad, like, because very poor sea boats. Anyway, in the end, I started trying to get the lads to get us along. Well, we got to about 20 feet from the stern, and the propellers, then as the ship rolled, propellers was coming right out of the water. And at the same time, there must have been some sort of steam or something on, because the propellers was going around very, very, very slowly, and she was twin screw. One was out that side and one was out that side. And as I started to get clear of the stern, it was obvious I was going to get hit onto the propeller. You follow it all? It's like, yeah. So then I started getting really tough with the crew, shouting and bawling and hitting them to try and punch. So I got on one side of the Carly float with one paddler, and I put three on the other side, and I could beat them. You've got to remember that I think it was two of the lads aboard had only just joined the ship, we'll say 48 hours before, the first time in the Navy, and they were all sick and crying for the mothers and all this. And anyway, eventually got off the ship. But I think we capsized about four or five times. Every time we went up in the air, she just blew over. But a Carly float has got a net in the centre. Do you know a Carly float? It's you know, like a tube with a... I was upright. Anyway, kept losing a hand. And then there was one lad called Johnson. His mate Corr, he was lost on, he went over the side. It ended up there was three of us left on. There was myself, the midshipman had been drowned. There's a lad called Saunders and another lad, young lad, didn't know him very well then. And I'd gone after one to try and get him back. And the seas were so long, they were about, oh, a couple of hundred yards between each sea. And I knew if I stayed in between the troughs, I was safe. But if I went over the troughs one end, I'd never get back to the Carly float. Anyway, I went after one. In the end, I just about had it. We'd been in the water a long time then, and it was off Iceland or up north somewhere, like we were. And I'd almost given up and said no. Anyway, kept on trying to swim down, but eventually got just to the top of the wave. And a young lad, I think his name was Johnson, this one, we had a big paddle in oar, and he threw this to me, and he skimmed it. Always remember, if you threw it, he had a blade on it like that, like a, not an ordinary oar, an ordinary blade, like a sculling oar with a big blade on it. And it, he landed the right way, and it skimmed like that in the water. And he got to me, and I hung on to that, and eventually got back to the ship. But by this time, it was getting, you know, we were all in then. But the Glenartney came, and he must have drifted down onto it to give us some lee. Anyway, there was, I'm not sure it was three or four was left. Anyway, in the end, there were soldiers on the ship as well, guns crews and all this, you know, the Dems, they called them then, like. They were pulling us up, and there was one lad, I'd put the bowline round him, and as he started to get up the side of the ship, whether I didn't make the knot right or something, I don't know, but anyway, he fell back in the water, and he was drowned. And I think there was three of us got back aboard all right, like, you know, got heaved up. And we must have been so cold, I don't know how cold we were. I was sort of no feeling. And apparently we were put in a bath. And I said to the officer, always remember it, haven't you got any hot water aboard here? Like, and the bloke said, well, the water's absolutely boiling. And he gave me a full tumbler full of whiskey or rum. He said, drink this, which you shouldn't do today. Like, and I'd never even felt the whiskey or rum. Like, you know, it was anyway, I think I slept for 36 hours. And on the way back, we were told we were going to land in Belfast. Anyway, 12 days later, we landed in Freetown. So we went all the way back. You know, no.
And when did the Coleman go down?
She sank then, like, you know. Very important, very interesting. I didn't see it go down. She did sink there and then, like, you know. I believe the story goes that the Broke came up on the scene then. And Peter Scott, I met him afterwards talking about it. He came with Jimmy the One, and he did get alongside the Cormorant, and a lot of the crew. I've got a book somewhere about the Cormorant. They were jumping. What the crew of the Broke were doing, they put all mattresses and everything over the guardrails. And as the crew off the Cormorant was jumping, as the Broke went up in the air like that, and the Cormorant went down to port, we'll say, the crew was jumping off the, but a lot of them broke the legs and all this, like, a few was lost on her. You reckon there was about 80 lost altogether on her, like, no, 60 lost on her.
And you were rescued by which year?
Cormorant, the Glenartney. and I was on my trawler in Birkenhead once, just coming in, and the I seen a ship, and I thought, I'm sure that ship's, I know it. And it was the Glenartney coming into Birkenhead. This was a few years ago, much, you know, only 10, 15 years ago, like, you know. But anyway, the skipper, who was a Captain Evans from Cardiff, he was on it when he picked us all up, but he'd passed and gone. You know.
And what was the date that the Cormorant sank?
The April the 6th. She sank April the 6th.
1941,
I think it would be. I think it was 41. But Peter's got but a painting. It's in the Royal Academy, which you'd like to see. I've seen my sister London Life was a big magazine once, whether it's still going like that, you know, very big back book. Have you ever seen London Life? And in the centre page was the painting of this, and it said, one of the epics of the war. And then Peter Scott painted it. Like, no. She brought it and showed me, but it's gone with the wind, you know.
What kind of a ship was the Lincoln?
She was a four-funnel American destroyer. But she was taking it very hard herself, because the weather was atrocious. Like, you know, these, we got 50 destroyers off the Yanks. One of them it was. Like, you know.
So this was up towards Iceland?
This was, we reckon we were up off Iceland. The water was so cold, getting around. The water was warmer than the air, because all steam was coming off of us, remember, like, you know, it was cold.
How long were you in the water for?
About 8 hours. When I would say 8 hours, and afterwards I got a special medical. And I got over it all right. No, well, I didn't suffer at all, really. But you've got to remember what everybody said. Now, I've talked to doctors. How is it that I stood up to that? They said, with me being used to small boats and very, very fit, and all the exertion that I'd done kept me warm. He said, if I'd have just packed up, not helping the other lads and all this, you know, that might have done it, you know, so. Even now I'm in the water all the time, it's nothing now. Even last night, my boots were full of water. There's not a day, and I mean this, there's not a day that I can honestly remember, not even Christmas Day, that I don't go out on the shore.
Were you a good swimmer in those days?
Yes, I can. I won the mile, Northern Ireland Mile Championship. I've always been, I've lived in the water virtually, like, you know, so that's no. You've got to remember, I've done nothing else. It's always been boats from a little lad, like, you know. I know I couldn't swim once when I was about 8, and we used to have a big jetty down here, and I got talking to an old fisherman. I said, I can't swim. And he got hold of me and threw me in, and he said, now you can start swimming. And it was only doggy, like, you know, but I think he did have to pull me out, actually.
Did you have any nightmares about this incident afterwards?
I've never ever forgot that, like. No, I think the Malcolm was probably the much more harder time than the. That was a lot worse, like, you know.
We've got this to come. So, after this, what happened to you after the loss
of
the
Comet? I think I'd been made. I was leading seamen by then, like, you know. We landed at Freetown, and I stayed there for a short time, and came back on the Dunnoffy Castle, it was, to England, and got put ashore. I'm just trying to think now. And then I went to a camp called Wembley. It was when Plymouth Blitz was on then, I think. And I got the Exeter to come back from the Graf's Bay do. And our guns had been put on a gun site at Wembley, and I got put in guns crew at this Plymouth Blitz, and I was there while the Blitz was on. And then
what did you see of that, the Plymouth?
Oh, it was bad deal. Plymouth was, it was very bad deal. But we were out, so we only went in during the daylight hours to give a hand doing things, like, you know, and never got involved with the, how should we say, the bombing, but we were guns crew.
But you did clearing up in Plymouth?
Where were they, sir?
Did you do clearing up in Plymouth?
A bit, not a great deal. It was mostly training on this gun site. We had a little island called the Moonstone, and we were used to see the minesweepers coming in and get blown up, hitting mines and sinking and all that thing. Seen quite a lot of that at Plymouth.
Were you firing the guns at planes?
Oh yes. Well, we had a box. We never fired at individual planes. There was quite a lot of batteries right round Plymouth, Marines and all sorts of, and you just fired it into a box, you see, hoping you did something.
Did any bombs fall near you, or did you get strafed?
No, we never got not any near us. You could see them, say, a mile away, but nothing to us.
And after this?
Well, I went up to Liverpool then for a while, and I went to Captain D's coxswain at the place I was at was Oddle Hay, but it was Derby House, really. Met Max Orton and Sir Percy Noble. Had quite a few interesting dudes Sir Percy Noble served on. And
can you tell me about any incidents with them?
Well, we... Not incidents actually referring to the wars, joking. You know, sometimes you had some funny experiences, but nothing...
Can you tell me about any of the funny experiences?
Well, my job at the time was looking after Captain D. He was Captain McCoy. He was... There was one instance that he used to ring a bell when he wanted anything particular, like, you know, and he just said to me, you better run a bath for me, Jones, he said. Anyway, in the same bathroom, the Wrens used to go and make the tea and take it round to the officers in different offices, like, you know. I ran the captain's bath, went and told him it was ready, and apparently he went in and he'd had his bath and was just standing up in the bath, and one of the Wrens walked in, a girl called Joan, and must have seen him in his nakedness, if you like. And anyway, I suppose that was bad enough, but unfortunately Captain D lived at a place outside Liverpool called Freshfield. And he'd asked me, or ordered me, to give his steward and cook and such like a hand, as all the top brass was coming. And there was Sir Percy Noble, Admiral Horton, Lord Louis Mountbatten, and Admiral Ritchie, and the ladies. And it was quite a posh spread, this. Anyway, Captain D was telling this incident, and he said, I think it would be best if Jones told you what happened, like afterwards, like, you know, but it didn't come to anything. It's only more of a joke, it was.
Any memories of Max Horton?
He was we all reckoned he was a gentleman. He came down when we were going to ram the boom at Algiers with the broke. This was quite a long time afterwards. And he gave us a down-to-earth talking about like him, but he was a very genuine gentleman like him.
What happened after this period as coxswain to Captain D?